Well, this, as I told you on the phone, this was a wonderful novel. I really enjoyed the book. It's such an interesting idea. I think in this New York Times article, you talked a little bit about how this book came about, but, of course, my audience doesn't read the New York Times at all. They want to find out about books. They listen to the radio. Tell me a little bit about how Soldiers in Hiding came about.
Well, I met an old man in Tokyo in about 1971, when I moved to Tokyo from up country, who had been an American citizen and had been drafted into the Japanese Army because he had gone to Japan previous to the war and stayed too long. And although he went to China and marched around for 4 years and nothing really interesting happened to him, the idea that that could happen stuck with me. And when I got around to writing a book about Japan, I kept that idea, and the story evolved from that.
And, of course, your characters are put in a very awkward moral dilemma, whereas American citizens drafted into the Japanese Army, they are, in effect, told to put to death an American soldier. And a lot of the novel deals with this moral dilemma. Tell me a little more as you developed this book and your characters, how they came about.
Well, Teddy, the main character, was a man of ambiguous personal and ethnic origins when he was living in Los Angeles, because he was Japanese. He was going to high school with all these regular American kids. So he latched onto music as his way of making himself in that society, and he turned out to be very good at it. But he wasn't the strong one. The strong one in America and in the early years in Japan was his friend Jimmy, who didn't say much, wasn't well-educated, but had a certain charismatic strength, which drew Teddy, and also he was a wonderful trumpet player, equal to Teddy's ability to play the guitar. So he followed Jimmy in all ways, not only musically, but also in terms of the way he looked at the world for those first few years, until Jimmy, as you know from having read the book, ended up leaving the novel rather early on, and then Teddy had to make his own decisions. So the idea of his national identity and his ability to make decisions came into the book, I think, with the death of Jimmy. Not that I want to tell too much about the book.
It's interesting. More and more seems to be being written about the Japanese, who in some respects are becoming less scrutable and becoming more like real people to us. For years, it seemed to me the Japanese were just a mystery, and Tokyo was an insular city, expensive. Nobody went there, but that seems to be changing now. Is that right?
Well, it was never that way. It's all a matter of perception. When I lived there, which was from 70 to late 74, it was every bit as real as it is now, but the perception of its reality is coming clearer to Americans now because they're becoming economically successful and they're beginning to flaunt it a little bit. And that coming out economically has made us sit up and pay attention. It's been going on ever since the Japanese automobiles started outselling ours. But as far as being a real people with a real culture to be found by anyone with the energy to look for it at the time, it's been there. It's always been there, and it came back into its own not more than, I'd say, 5 years after the war. And there was a kind of a defeat shock went on for about 5 years. But after that, they started to thaw out, and they haven't changed too much.
But I'm beginning to view Japanese as individuals, as people, whereas perhaps I didn't have that perception of them before because they seemed so uniform, they seemed alike, they seemed so regimented. But then I saw Gung Ho with Michael Keaton. So Japanese are becoming more real, and of course you make them real in Soldiers in Hiding. What took you to Japan anyway?
Well, I was in the Peace Corps in Korea in the 60s, and I stopped off on the way home, and it took me 5 years to leave again. I don't know. I coming back to America in 69 with all of the anti-war activities and upheaval, and with me having lived in a Korean village for 2 years, it seemed like a better idea to come in step by step. And I got interested in Japan. I got very interested in learning Japanese, which I think is the key to any culture, speaking the language. And so it took me 5 years to complete that process so that I understood the language and the people well enough to feel like I could leave it behind.
What did you do in Japan over that five-year period?
I taught English as a second language, as did virtually every native speaker of English that I met there. I went to graduate school at Sophia University and ended up getting a master's degree in Japanese history, and simply because I stayed so long, taking like one course a semester. And then I wrote a little bit of fiction.
Are you familiar with the work of Brad Lighthouser?
I haven't read the book, but I'm familiar with the reviews of the book.
Yeah, see, I can't remember the title of the book, but it was a very nice, very well done book, very well executed book about young American expatriates living in Japan.
Yeah, just something that I've been meaning to get around to, but yeah. I haven't yet.
It's nicely done. But his conclusion did seem to be that the East is East and West is West, and somehow there's a cultural gap that can never be reconciled. What is your feeling about that?
That's true and not true. The key to reconciling cultural differences is in language. And in order to understand Japan, you've got to learn Japanese. Otherwise, it becomes... I mean, to understand it intellectually, it's easy enough. People tell you aspects of the culture, and if you're paying attention and if you're smart, you end up understanding what they're saying and retaining it. But to really know the place... The absence of Japanese language will limit you severely, because the nature of reality for the Japanese is based on the structure of their language, just like ours is based upon the structure of English. My very opinions on the same subject would occasionally change depending on whether I was speaking English or Japanese. I couldn't be so frank, I couldn't be so forthright in Japanese as I might be in English. On a subject, the Vietnam War was a subject we talked about a lot during those days. In English, I might have had a very adamant anti-war opinion, but in Japanese, I had to mitigate it by the way the language worked, so that I softened it and circumlocuted and went around the back and never really said too clearly what I thought. But again, to say I never really said too clearly what I thought is an English version of how language works. To the Japanese, it's perfectly clear.
How did you fit in during that five-year period in Japan? Did you feel comfortable?
Yes, extremely comfortable. Made friends easily. I tried to avoid...
Japanese friends?
Oh, yes. I tried to avoid American friends as much as possible during those years. I wanted to learn Japanese, and for the first 9 months, I wouldn't speak English. I kept even once or twice, I would say I was from Czechoslovakia or something, to avoid having to practice English with a Japanese English student, for example. But by the time I got my sea legs, if you will, in Japanese, I could speak better than most Japanese could speak English, I was willing to speak a little English to people. But I was in the culture for 5 years, completely. Had no contact whatsoever with expatriate Americans, except on an individual or personal level.
Your wife is not Japanese?
No, she's from the Philippines. But we met in Tokyo and we're married there.
Well, let's go back even further than Korea and Japan. Tell me how it all began. You're from the state of Washington, is that right?
Right. I grew up in Tacoma, Washington. Went to all through school there and all through my first experience with the university. I went to the University of Puget Sound and left in 67 to join the Peace Corps.
What kind of background do you have? Did you grow up in a literary household?
No, not necessarily. Ordinary middle-class household. My brother's a jazz musician, so that put me in contact, I think, with the idea of expressing oneself through some kind of art, whether it be music or literature or painting or whatever. But, it was an ordinary, rather idyllic childhood on Puget Sound.
Did you do any writing as a child?
A little bit, but that really started in earnest when I was in college.
It never occurred to you then until fairly late that you would like to develop a literary background.
It occurred to me to make a real effort at it rather than using it as a conversation piece in about 1972, I'd say, when I was living in Tokyo. Although I'd been long out of college and I'd done writing in college, it was more or less as a tool for impressing other people. And when I finally got serious about it in about 71 or 72... Since then, I've been working on it pretty much as hard as I can.
Well, Soldiers in Hiding is not your first book.
It's not my first book, no. It's my first published book.
Well, tell me about those earlier starts.
Well, I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop after coming back from Japan. I was there from 74 to 76. And at first, I tried my hand at writing short stories, which is the natural rhythm of that workshop, so that something can be completed and showed to other people fairly regularly. I tried my hand at short stories, but always found that they weren't complete. They were like excerpts. The short story is not my forte. So I started a novel based upon my Korean experiences, which was called Festival for 3,000 Maidens. It was a good novel, but a learning experience. I don't think now that I would publish it, even if someone said they would be glad to do so. I learned the craft. I learned the way of developing character and voice and scope of scene and lyricism and all of that in that book. Then when I finished that, I wrote another book called Fool's Gold, which a 10-year later version is here with me now in New York. That book I had a lot of luck with near misses. I got a $1,200 option advance once from a publisher here in town and thought it would work out, but in the end it didn't. I must have received 25 rejections on that version of that book. So I put it away and I started Fool's Gold. I mean, Soldiers in Hiding. Right after that, worked on that for nearly 6 years. Even though it's a slight book in terms of numbers of pages, it took years. And then I went back to Fool's Gold, which is now completed in a rather more sophisticated version than it was at first. So maybe something will happen with that in the next few weeks.
When you wrote Soldiers in Hiding, did you work closely with the editor?
No. When I wrote the book, it was completed before it was purchased by Atlantic Monthly Press. So the editor, who was wonderful, did a lot of work on the book, but in the most minute ways, and talking about the uses of the difference between that and which in a sentence, and talking about whether or not there were stained glass windows in Japan in 1940, that kind of thing. But as far as the plot and the main story goes, it was totally completed at the time I sold it.
Well, it was certainly an honor to win the Penn Faulkner Award. I mean, that doesn't happen to everybody, and that's certainly a boost for you, and it's probably an impetus for you to do even more. Now you've finished your fourth novel, and so I would imagine this is going to be an even greater incentive to do more work in terms of literary endeavors.
It's an amazing shot in the arm. I live in Nairobi now, and I got the call on the Penn Faulkner. In fact, all of the calls that I got concerning it woke me up. I was always asleep, and it took me a long time to figure out whoever it was on the other end of the line, what they were talking about. But it was astounding to me.
Somebody from the awards committee.
Somebody
called
from the Nairobi. Yeah, from the awards committee called me. It was only around midnight, but I was asleep, and for the longest time I had no idea what they were talking about. Finally, I came clear to it, and that's been almost a month now. Ever since then, it's been an amazing sequence of telephone calls and this trip back to the United States quite unexpectedly, and it's been wonderful.
What took you to Nairobi?
Oh, I'm working there. I have tended to be in education of one kind or another ever since I left Japan. I worked in education in Washington State for a while, went to Nigeria for a while to become the principal of the American International School there. And then I got a job over in Nairobi as executive secretary of the Association of International Schools in Africa. So that's what I'm doing now for employment, and I've been there just a year.
Ooh, what do you do in that capacity?
There are 50 or so schools in sub-Saharan Africa which have American curriculum expatriate students, and I run an association of those schools and put on conferences for teachers, write a newsletter, help them hire staff, as a kind of clearinghouse for teachers and for curriculum. It's interesting.
Of course, you've lived out of the country for quite a number of years off and on, but what's it like in Nairobi? Any kind of cultural problem?
No, it's the easiest place I've lived. It's the fourth time, Korea, Japan, Nigeria, and now Kenya, and it's the easiest. It's a beautiful city. It's got the most wonderful climate on earth. It's 5,000 feet high, sunny and clear all the time. It's easy, it's full of good restaurants, it's not particularly expensive. And it's gifted with all of the animals and flowers and birds that that we all hear about.
Is there a Western orientation in the town? You live in like a ranch house or something like an apartment building?
There are. I live in a big stone house outside of town, about 15 minutes north of the city. And it's a Kenyan idea of what a Western house should be like. It's a very strange house, lots of dead end corridors and things. But it's very large. Things there are large. The average garden or yard is probably four times the size of what it would be in a suburban city in the United States.
What's it like for your family?
Very good. My children are in love with the animals. My son and I, when I heard about the Pen Faulkner, we took the car and drove out on the savannah looking for lions the next day. And he looking for lions, me thinking about the award. Mm-hmm. And it's very nice that way.
How old are the kids?
10 and a half and 6 and a half, respectively, girl and boy.
At the same time, you have to stock up on Western products to take back, right?
Yes, that's true. I'm in the market for fruit roll-ups and M&Ms and those kinds of things. I've got a very strict orders from everyone in my family on what to buy. They're interested in those products, and they don't exist there. Although the basics, meats and cheeses and vegetables and fruits are bountiful, they are interested in M&Ms and fruit roll-ups.
Well, aren't we all? So the Pen Faulkner, the award hasn't been formally presented yet, has it?
No, Saturday next in Washington, D.C.
Well, that should be cause for a party.
I'm going down tomorrow, and I'm looking very much forward to it.
Well, it's a wonderful beginning, Richard Wiley, and I certainly enjoyed the book. I congratulate you, and I appreciate that you were able to squeeze me in on this visit, because I know you've had a lot of things coming and going at you, and I know that's the way it is when you're traveling. But
thank you. It's my pleasure.
It was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.